I'm going to give a little talk today about what is, the title is Clarifying Holographic Charges. Let me explain what that means. I want to talk about a subject which really lives properly in pure classical gravitational physics. After all, that's largely what I am, as a gravitational physicist. However, the construction is motivated by and has certain things to do with ADS-CFT, thus the name holographic charges. These are the, for those of you who know this business, these are the conserved charges for gravitational systems that were defined by people like Kostas Skounderas and Vijay Balasubramanian and Per Kraus. And there's some interesting questions about the status, there have been interesting questions about the status of such charges that I will clarify during this talk. All right. So as background, as I say, the talk is really classical gravity, but the motivation for the whole story comes from ADS-CFT. So let me just write down something about how we understand ADS-CFT. So, of course, we think about a gravitational system that lives in ADS space. I assume that this diagram is familiar to everyone in the room. And we often define the correspondence, well, we do define the correspondence, by equating what we call the partition function of two systems, one being string theory in ADS space, so this is, I'll call this the ADS partition function, and the other being the partition function of some sort of conformal field theory. And of course, this by itself is not necessarily a very interesting correspondence. What's more interesting is if we have not just one number on each side to identify, but some family of things. And of course, the fun thing to do with conformal field theories is to deform them by sources. Okay. Now, what does it mean to deform it by a source? Well, for example, we might add to the action something proportional to the stress energy tensor, which we would know, for example, is equivalent to modifying the background metric. So I could just as easily say that instead of thinking of this as a function of sources, I can think about this as a function of what we might call background fields. So the story of the ADS-CFT correspondence is that these two partition functions are equal if I map the background fields that are backgrounds for the CFT into boundary values for the fields that live in the bulk here. Okay. So for example, if I was working in the approximation with the string theory and the bulk can be described by classical supergravity, I might be interested in the boundary value of the gravitational field. Okay. Now, good. As I say, what I'm really interested in is sort of classical gravity, and so I'll be interested in using this as motivation in the regime where I can approximate what's going on in the bulk by classical gravity. In that case, this partition function is essentially, in a semi-classical approximation, it becomes e to the minus the classical action for some gravitating system on ADS, or if I'm in Minkowski signature, if I'm in Lorentz signature, it's e to the I f ADS. The reason I wanted to write all this down is that although this is a straightforward thing in the ADS-CFT correspondence and now familiar to almost every string theorist, this just way of thinking about a problem changes one's perspective on classical gravity a lot, because it suggests that you should think that it's useful to think about a classical gravitating system, say Einstein-Hilbert gravity in ADS space or supergravity in ADS space, ultimately ADS 5 cross S 5. It suggests it's useful to think about the action for such a system as having not just one fixed set of boundary conditions, but it's useful to think about the partition function and therefore the action itself as a functional of various possible boundary conditions you could impose on the field. Okay, and that's not a way of thinking that was natural to gravitational physicists before ADS-CFT, but it's certainly natural in this context. Okay? So, in particular, let's focus, as I say, on the gravitational field, the metric. Okay? In that case, what do we mean by the boundary value of the metric? Well, as you probably know, in an asymptotically empty de Sitter space-time, the metric, in fact, becomes very large on the boundary in the reasonable sense. It sort of diverges there. So what one does is to pick some conformal factor, usually called omega, some scalar function on the space-time that we will use as a conformal factor. We pick some function omega, such that omega equals 0 on the boundary, And also, since this is a math building, I'll mention that what you're really supposed to do is first work on a conformal compactification of anti-de-Sitter space and choose omega to be something which is smooth on the conformal on the conformally compactified spacetime as well. But you pick some omega that goes to zero on the boundary at an appropriate rate, and then what we call the boundary value of the gravitational field is some object which is another metric tensor, but of lower rank, which is the limit as omega goes to zero of the original metric rescaled by a power of omega squared. And also, what we want to do is actually think about it effectively a metric on the boundary. So what you do is you take your function omega, you foliate the spacetime by surfaces on which omega equals constant. On each supposition omega equals constant surface, you compute the induced metric. So you get a metric of on a spacetime of one dimension lower. You rescale by omega squared, and you take this limit. And it's well understood that for asymptotically ADS spacetimes, this gives you a well-defined limit. Okay? So this, I assume I'm reviewing familiar stuff and just setting up the motivation for what I'm actually going to do. The point is that once you have all this technology, and you think about the classical gravity action as a function of this metric on the boundary, it is natural to do what you would do in a CST to define conserved quantities like energy, momentum, etc. And so Skinderas, Bala Subramanian, and Krauss all suggested that, aha, we know that if we look in a gravitational textbook like Wald or MTW or something for definitions of energy and gravity, it's kind of a mess, and there's all these complications that occur for normal systems. So what if we introduce a new definition based on this ADS, motivated by ADS CFT? What if we define what they call the boundary or holographic stress tensor, which is TAB, in a way that you would do it for the CFT? You just say it's minus 2 divided by the square root of the determinant of the metric associated with the CFT, in other words, the boundary value of the bulk metric, times delta F, delta H, AB. And then, presumably, you can define a conserved quantity by contracting this with a Killing vector field in the spacetime in which the CFT lives. So suppose we have some vector field, which is a Killing vector field of the boundary metric. Then we can define a charge, QC, which is just the usual kind of expression, the integral of the square root of minus h, some kind of normal to a surface. We integrate this over some hypersurface through the boundary spacetime. So, well, I guess I won't draw it. But this is now a D minus 2 surface. It's a codimension 1 in the boundary spacetime. Okay. CB, TAB. All right. This is what you would do to define the conserved charge in the conformal field theory. Okay. And you expect, because you believe in ADS CFT, that this is a well-defined construction in the gravity theory, and that it should be equal to whatever is a natural notion of energy, momentum, angular momentum, etc., in the gravitational theory, because that's certainly what seems to be suggested by the correspondence. However, at least when you first write this down, you ought to really treat this as a question. Because after all, relativists in years before ADS CFT wrote down other definitions of energy, momentum, angular momentum, etc., and it is worthwhile to at least pause and ask whether or not the two are in fact equal. Right? Okay. In fact, as you well know, in many simple examples, for example, pure ADS 5 or ADS Schwarzschild, the two are not quite equal. If you compare what I will call QC, the counterterm charge, with what I will call HC. So these are, this is going to be, H is my notation for charges previously defined by relativists. Okay? And why do I call them H? It's because, as I'll remind you in a minute, the main mechanism they used for deriving, for constructing these quantities is basically Hamiltonian mechanics in the bulk. So these are what I'll call these are the previous charges. I'll call them Hamiltonian charges. Okay. All right. If you compute the, say, energy of pure ADS-5 or ADS-Schwarzschild using these holographic stress tensors, and if you compare it with a standard relativist answer, you find that at least in five-dimensional ADS space, the answer is not zero. It's some non-zero number. Okay? Not zero. But in simple examples like this, you find that it's independent of which example you compute. Okay, so at least in simple examples, it appears to be a non-zero constant. Okay, it appears to be a non-zero, or in other words, it's a C number. Okay, now that's a good answer. And the truth is, if you think about it, that's just fine with ADS-CFT as well, because after all, what is energy? Well, it's a thing which generates time translations, and if I add a constant to my generator for time translations, it still generates time translations now, doesn't it? Okay. But nevertheless, the relationship is somewhat subtle and deserves to be investigated more. Yes? Excuse me? Oh, good question. Right. What I mean by a constant? Yes. What I mean, in fact, by a constant, well, we will investigate this, but what I'll break the suspense, and what I mean by a constant is something which depends on, it can depend on the boundary values, for example, HAB. Okay, of course, it does, you know that this object, which is basically the energy in the field theory, depends on the metric the field theory lives on because it's a conformal anomaly, so it depends on that. As a result, it also depends, from the bulk point of view, on the choice of the conformal compactification, because, of course, when you compute HAB from the bulk metric, it goes through omega. Okay, and it can depend on other background structures, on other non-dynamical structures, like lambda. Like the cosmological constant. Or in the number of brains. But I work from a bulk perspective, so it's lambda. Okay, right. But by observation, we find that it has this property in simple examples. All right? However, it's worth asking, is this true in general? In particular, if you followed some of the recent literature on the subject, there have been several challenges to this idea and the several suggestions that maybe there should be something much more complicated going on. Briefly, a survey of the literature is about 4 years ago, Ashtekar and Das tried to do this computation where they said, okay, on these simple space-times, you find that it's this sort of constant structure, independent of dynamical information, but what if I compute this in general? And they got some gorgeous, you know, half-page expression, and they said, doesn't look constant. We don't see how this could be constant. All right. More recently, there have been various issues where people have done calculations involving black holes in various kinds of ADS backgrounds, and they've used these holographic charges and come up with answers which do not appear to satisfy the first law of thermodynamics. Okay. On the other hand, there are general proofs due to Wald that these guys do satisfy the first law of thermodynamics. So there's a sort of tension that's going on there. Now, again, I will actually cut through any suspense and tell you that that particular worry went away. It was actually caused by a sort of an error. People computed the wrong thing. When they were varying parameters in the first law, when they were doing their DS and DE, they accidentally changed omega at the same time. But still, the point becomes clear that it's worthwhile to go through and really find out for sure what's going on here. Are these the same things or not? Now, again, from ADS-CFT, you expect that they're at least more or less the same thing. Okay, we decided now a constant's allowed. Might other freedom be allowed? I mean, what we really expect from ADS-CFT is that this had better be conserved, and this is conserved. The difference is conserved, but Might it be, in general, a combination of the other conserved charges, for example? All right. So lots of things to sort out. Also, if life is this complicated in the case of what is essentially pure ADS space, here I've been talking about examples that have trivial boundary fields, or in other words, really not interesting sources from the CFT point of view, what about more complicated cases? What if we're interested in, say, ADS CFT for these cascading field theories in space-times, something that Alex Buchel and Ofer Aharoni recently looked at and studied the holographic normalization of? We would like to do the same construction, but obviously we haven't tested many cases there, because there you can't even do this calculation, because you can't exactly compute, well, no one's computed these guys for such cascading space-times. But you'd like to know, is it going to work in general? So, the goal of my talk today is to clarify this and tell you, again, I'll break the suspense, that in general, this is the answer, prove a theorem that this is true, under essentially general conditions. Anything which is asymptotically ADS, well, I'll prove a theorem without even using the fact that it's explicitly asymptotically ADS. So in fact, the theorem that I will prove eventually, if I get that far today, shows that even if we manage to generalize ADS-CFT to many other space, well, we actually have done so already, of course, there are cascading spacetimes, there are dualities for D0 brain spacetimes, and so forth, but the theorem I'm going to prove today applies equally well to all such cases. So we can just move forward. I should mention that with Holland and Ishibashi, we actually wrote two papers on this subject. The first one we did the old-fashioned way, which was by bashing on things with long calculations. Okay, in that paper, we proved this result for exactly the case where we work in ADS 5 with trivial boundary fields. Okay, and that paper uses sort of standard familiar techniques. You take things, you expand the Einstein equation, the equations of motion around infinity, you work in perturbatively, you beat on it for a long time, and you take that long expression that Ashtekar and Das worked out that they said doesn't look constant to us, and you stick in various things that come from the equations of motion at various orders in perturbation theory, and voila, it becomes constant. Okay. So I'm not going to talk about that work today, because it'll be a long, dull talk, and it's a kind of a limited result anyway. But the more general result turns out to follow by a nice, general sort of argument. So I'm going to do that for you today. Okay? And actually, for one comment I made earlier, the structure of the right kind of general argument has probably become clear. I'm going to give you an argument that proves this without actually having to construct these charges first. Okay? The way I do that is just that, as I said, what I know is that, by definition, the way that a relativist does define energy, or some other conserved charge, is that it is the generator of some symmetry. Of course, that's what the right answer, obviously, right? So what I'm really going to prove for you today is just to show that these holographic charges, over there, are in fact generators of the appropriate symmetry, okay, using the bulk gravitational, using the right Poisson algebra for the bulk. If I can do that, then it's clear that the difference between that generator and any other generator of the symmetry is something which is a constant over the phase space, and therefore can depend on no dynamical information, but can only depend on background non-dynamical structures. Okay? So that's the right story. It turns out, like many things, this is not difficult to do, but you simply have to use the right technology. Okay? If you tried to prove this using canonical, you know, decompose space-time into 3 plus 1 dimensions, go through compute Poisson brackets, I think it'd be a rather god-awful mess, and I certainly am not willing to try it myself. But with the right kind of covariant phase space techniques, this turns out to be a fairly simple construction. Okay? Oh, before I actually tell you what those techniques are, and in fact that's the large part of my talk, is to review the simple kind of covariant phase space techniques, let me mention one more issue which maybe running around in the back of your mind, which at least raises some interesting questions about the relationship between these guys and these guys. Okay? These guys, holographic charges, are defined in the same way you define the stress energy tensor for a field theory on a background spacetime. Right? This is what one often calls the gravitational stress tensor. On the other hand, if by definition the Hamiltonian charges are things that generate a symmetry transformation, well, those are things that you best know how to write down in general, in terms of what's called the canonical stress tensor. So this has some shades of reminiscence of the old, well, let's see, how exactly is the canonical stress tensor related to the gravitational stress tensor and all that? Okay. So again, so if you get nothing else out of this talk, hopefully I'll teach you a nice, pretty set of covariant phase space techniques that you might use the next time you're teaching a GR course and you wish to clarify for your students the relationship between the gravitational stress tensor and the canonical stress tensor, as the construction I'm going to show you can be turned. It turns out there's an important difference in doing the holographic charges, but it's very close to a construction that will easily show you that indeed the gravitational stress tensor in general not only gives you interesting conserved charges by this construction, but it also generates the appropriate symmetries in the classical theory of a field theory living on a background space-time with isometries. Okay, so this is all the motivation. The covariant phase space technique that we are going to use, that we use for this construction, is called the Pyrrhals bracket. And I'm just curious, how many people in the audience know what a Pyrrhals bracket is? Okay, one. You can skip the next part of the talk, because if you're sufficiently familiar with Pyrrhals brackets, most of the rest of the talk becomes fairly clear once you realize you should use it. So what I'm now going to do, thanks, if you could get the lights for me, just turn on the projector and give, oops, that way. It was easy when Alexa did it. Here, let me have a quick look.
Yes.
Oh, no, I think we just...
I don't know how to...
Isn't it?
Oh, it's just to...
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Okay, great. All right. So what I'm now going to do is actually spend most of the rest of the time giving you a short course on a lovely piece of classical mathematical physics called the Pyrrhals bracket. And once we've done the general story for that, if we have time, I'll show you the subtleties that are involved in applying the Pyrrhals bracket to the argument I'd like to make. But the truth is that this is actually more interesting for you to learn. Once you see this, you'll believe me that I can apply it directly and get the right answer. Okay? So we'll see if we get that far. All right. So I wanted to start, the definition of the Pyrrhals bracket may strike you as a little bit funny when I get there, but I wanted to remind you of something to make it seem much less funny. So something that probably everyone in this room is familiar with is the quantization of a free scalar field. Okay. Again, I'm going to do classical physics, but let's think about the quantum physics for a moment. You may recall that if I look at the algebraic structure of a free quantum scalar field, that I can write it, I can write the commutator as the difference between, with the usual factor of I, the advanced Green's function and retarded Green's function. Right? This is a kind of familiar statement. And of course, this, once one realizes this, it's one way to see immediately in a relativistic quantum field theory that the commutator vanishes outside of the light cone. Okay, lovely. The advanced Green's function, of course, is just the Green's function which vanishes in the past of the source, and the retarded, no. Advanced Green's function is the one that vanishes in the future of the source. The retarded Green's function is the one that vanishes in the past of the source. Okay, great. So the Pyrrhals bracket is a definition of a Poisson algebra or commutator algebra, which is just the analog of this for an arbitrary classical system, which I will first define and then take a brief minute to show you that it is equivalent to the usual Poisson bracket, just written in a more covariant way. So Pyrrhals had this lovely definition, a lovely idea that we could consider any classical dynamical system with the usual kind of evolution structure. That is, if it had some kind of Cauchy problem where you could specify initial data and then get unique evolution from there on. Okay. Or actually, this also works in the presence of gauge symmetries. In that case, if there are gauge symmetries present, we are in this talk only going to worry about defining the Pyrrhals bracket, A with B, of two gauge-invariant objects. It turns out you can extend it to the space of gauge-dependent objects, but that's a long story that we don't need. All right, so how do we define the Pyrrhals bracket of A with B? Well, the Pyrrhals bracket of A with B is naturally thought of as a function on the space of solutions to the theory. Okay. Now, good. Although you should first think of A and B as not being functions, as being more generally defined as, say, functions on the space of histories of the theory. So A, for example, might be the value of a scalar field at one point, or it might be the, say, the integral over a scalar field over some region of space-time, or anything else more complicated. All right. Please. Well, the space of so it works in the way in the naive way. I mean, the space of solutions is of course isomorphic to the phase space, and you're used to thinking about the phase space as going over in the quantum theory to the Hilbert space of the theory. Okay, so what it really it's the same story here, but from a more covariant point of view. What it really means is that you're going to be working in the classical equivalent of the Heisenberg picture. Okay, where states are things which are simply defined, and therefore, and in the Heisenberg picture, a state in the Hilbert space goes over to a small region in the space of solutions. Okay, so same kind of story. Just think Heisenberg picture instead of Schrodinger picture quantum mechanics. And after all, in field theory, we like Heisenberg pictures anyway, because we like to have field operators that run around in space-time points. It's not so complicated. In fact, this is the construction will remind you of many things that you do in quantum field theory. So to define this bracket, what we're going to do is we're going to define it as a function on space of solutions. So we start with some solution, I'll call it F, to the equations of motion. Okay? And I have in mind that the equations of motion should come from some sort of action principle where the action is this large F here. So to consider the bracket, what you do is you consider a deformed action, as you would do if you couple a source to a quantum field theory. And we'll take the deformation to be the first object, A. So we consider a new action, which is S plus epsilon A. This, of course, gives us new and different equations of motion. Okay? But suppose it's the case that A is something that is supported in some finite region of the space-time, so it vanishes to the far past and the far future. Then the equations of motion are deformed only in the middle, as you would if you added a source and computed a Green's function. So it's natural, then, the classical theory, to consider two different solutions to the deformed equations which are related to the original solution F. I could construct a solution to the deformed equations by starting with initial data that agrees with my original solution F in, say, the far past, and then evolving forward with the deformed equations of motion. That gives us what we'll call the retarded solution, F epsilon minus. Or I could start with initial data that agrees with the original solution in the far future, and then evolve backwards, the advanced solution S epsilon plus. Okay, great. Once I know how each solution changes, if I look at my second quantity B, I can evaluate that quantity B on the deformed solution and on the original solution. I can compute the difference, in fact, divide by epsilon, take the limit, and I get some notion of the change. Okay. Well, the Pyrrhus bracket is just defined to be, look at how B changes when I deform the action by A and use advanced boundary conditions, then do that again with retarded boundary conditions and compute the difference. Okay? If you think through it, in the case where A and B are just scalar fields, this turns out to be the advanced Green's function minus retarded Green's function. In general, it can be built from the advanced retarded Green's functions by taking appropriate functional derivatives of A and B and integrating over space-time. Okay? So it's a straightforward kind of analog. It satisfies all your favorite properties of a Poisson bracket. It has the usual sort of past-future symmetry. If you deform by A in the past and evaluate, deform by A in the future and evaluate B in the past, it turns out that that's actually the same as deforming by B in the future, and evaluating A in the future. In other words, there's a relation like this, which is really just the statement that the advanced Green's function at points x and y is equal to the retarded Green's function with the points flipped around. Okay. So once you realize that, it's clear this is in fact an antisymmetric object because I could replace this second expression here with dB plus A, and then it's explicitly antisymmetric in A and B. Yeah. you work a bit harder, you can show this satisfies the Jacobi identity in general, which is another important property. A could be a local operator. Why not? That's right. Sure, why not? And you're familiar with this. This is what you do in quantum field theory. You just store it by some local source. And we do it for the classical action. Same thing. But it can be a local operator here, a local object here. There's no problem at all. That is best defined in such cases. Strictly speaking, to really define this, in fact, I need A to be somewhat localized. I really need it to vanish in the far past and the far future so that my notion of advanced retarded vanishers is well defined. Things which do not vanish in the past and future I can define by a limiting procedure. Yeah, use some test functions and so forth. But it's just this story. Okay. Now, of course, the point is, so I've defined some object. I wish to claim that this gives us a meaningful function on the space of solutions, but in order to compute it, I had to start with A being defined on a bigger space. See, if A was only defined on the space of solutions, I wouldn't know how to vary it to get equations of motion in general. I wouldn't know how to do a local variation of A to get equations of motion. So I needed A to be defined on the entire space of histories first. So I need to take a minute to show you that indeed this gives us a well-defined bracket on the space on functions on the space of solutions. That is, if I now modify A by something which vanishes due to the equations of motion, it doesn't change the algebraic structure. Okay, that's not hard. All I have to do is consider an equation of motion. So let's consider. Here's my notation for an equation of motion. It's the thing I get. It's the functional derivative of the action with respect to one of the... why not? Thank you very much. It's the functional derivative of the action with respect to one of the basic fields. I've written phi, but it doesn't matter. It could be a vector, tensor, general field. Okay. Well, so the point is, what we need to do to calculate the Pyrrhus bracket of this creature with anything else is to evaluate... To compute the Pyrrhus bracket of this creature with something else, say the quantity A, let's suppose that we deform the action by A, and then we need to just compute this creature, the original equation of motion, on the modified solution. But that's easy, because the modified equations of motion tell us that the original equation of motion plus the functional derivatives of the modification, A, vanish. And therefore, the original equations of motion evaluated on the modified solution are just minus the modification. Okay. And the important thing is that this is completely local and obviously doesn't care what initial conditions we put in. I calculated the answer without needing to know the initial conditions. So if I compute the advanced effect on an equation of motion due to an arbitrary distortion and the retarded effect on an equation of motion due to an arbitrary distortion, they're equal. So in the Pyrrhus bracket, they cancel out. And of course, what I'm going to do then, of course, is use the previously mentioned anti-symmetry of the Pyrrhus bracket to say that I would have gotten the same answer if I distorted the action by, quote, an equation of motion and computed the effects on A. So indeed, this algebra descends nicely to the space of solutions. And on the space of solutions, what is the algebra? Well, it's only going to be interesting if it's the usual Poisson structure. We don't want our holographic charges to generate some symmetry using a different algebraic structure than we actually have in the classical theory. So what I want to do is, of course, review for you the proof that this is just the usual Poisson algebra in disguise. So how will I do that? Well, let me take whatever classical theory we happen to have. Let us write the action in canonical form, which I can always do. This is just a change of variables on field space. In canonical form, it looks like a sum over momenta times time derivatives of positions minus a Hamiltonian. And of course, in this condensed nomenclature, implicit in this sum over I may also be an integration over space and so forth. Well, so what I wish to do is simply compute the Pyrrhus bracket of P of t with Q of t prime, and also Q of t with Q of t prime and P of t with P of t prime, and show that if I happen to evaluate those things at equal times, I get the canonical Poisson bracket relations, right? Then I'll have proven that, in fact, these two things are equivalent. All right, So there's some story here. Well, what do? If we want to, let's actually consider a general sort of local deformation of the action. So consider any quantity which is the integral of some function of momenta, coordinates, and time. Okay. And now let's look at the modified equations of motion. Well, obviously, we get the usual kind of Hamiltonian equations of motion with corrections involving the derivative of f with respect to momenta for q dot, derivative of f with respect to coordinates for p dot, etc. And now, the interesting thing to do is to consider what happens if this is localized at some time. In fact, if I wanted to compute, say, the Poisson, the Pyrrhos bracket of a coordinate with a momentum, I'd really just take f to be that one coordinate qi times a delta function in time. It's a local object, okay? But for convenience, let me just take this to be any function of the coordinates times a delta function at t0. And let's go and compute the advanced and retarded changes in the momenta and coordinates at some nearby but slightly later time, just so I can sort of regularize my delta function a bit. Okay? It turns out if you do this more carefully, you find out that it doesn't matter how you regularize the system, but let's just do it at a slightly later time. Well, since I chose, so I'm putting in a source at t0, that's here. I'm going to evaluate these quantities at a slightly later time. So it's clear that the advanced change in any quantity is just zero, because I impose boundary conditions up here in the future, evolve back to the time of interest, t0 plus, oh, that should say delta, and nothing has happened. I haven't hit the source yet. So obviously, these vanish. Okay. But what happens if instead I compute the retarded changes? I evolve from the past, impose boundary conditions down here, evolve through the source to some time just slightly later. Okay. Well, we do the usual kind of thing. In that case, the equations of motion have a delta function source term at t0, so q dot and p dot may both have delta function source terms at t0, except that, of course, for the particular case I'm looking at, where f is a function of q, there is a delta function source in p, because df dq is not 0, but for q dot, df dp is 0, because I chose f to be a function of q, right? So there's no delta function source there. So by the usual kind of constructions, that means that this is d, my pen got a little bad here, this is d minus p, the retarded change in p. Since p dot has a delta function, the p itself has a theta function discontinuity when the source acts at t0. But of course, q had no delta function in its equation of motion, so it has no discontinuity. Instead, it's smooth. Instead, it gives something which is smooth, and since it's the retarded change, it vanishes before t0. So after t0, it gives something which is order of p minus t0. Okay. So just to complete the calculation, what we now do is subtract this guy from that guy and take the limit as delta goes to 0, and you can see that indeed, Q with Q gives 0 because we had 0 up here, 0 from here, and because this gives 0 and the limit as t goes to t0, but P with Q gives something non-zero. Okay? And if we do the same construction again for P with P, we get again 0. So I've now gone through a nice, just straightforward calculation to show you that indeed the Pyrrhos algebra is equal to the Poisson algebra. Okay. All right. Now, I am indeed moving somewhat slowly, but that's fine. I actually think that you may get more in the long run from this nice treatment of Pyrrhos brackets than from the details of how to apply it to the case of interest. But the key slide is here. Here's the one-page proof of what's effectively Noether's theorem using the Pyrrhos argument. Okay? This is Rudolf Pyrrhos, the famous Pyrrhos from early 19... this paper is... You know, I think you're right. I always get this wrong. But yes, indeed. My apologies. Yep. It is the same guy. This is old technology from the 1930s, 40s, something like that. But very useful. Very useful. All right. And I think it should be the basis of every classical mechanics course. But that's just my opinion. Okay. Yes, it is. You who are about to write classical mechanics books should use the Pyrrhus bracket. And here's why. It's really because of this. It's because on this page is the entire proof of, well, essentially the entire proof of Noether's theorem using the Pyrrhus algebra, and it shows for you that it proves for you in general, for any symmetry, that the conserved quantity associated with that symmetry generates the appropriate transformation. Okay? That's something which is easy to show using canonical techniques if the symmetry is simple, like a rotation where it acts separately on coordinates and momenta. But for things where it in general mixes coordinates and momenta in an arbitrarily complicated way, it's a bit tricky to show using canonical techniques. But it's trivial to show here. Okay, so here's how it goes. Consider a symmetry of the action S. So we have some transformation where the various fields undergo some change, phi goes to phi plus delta phi, under which the action is invariant. S of phi plus delta phi is equal to S of phi. So this is some symmetry transformation on the space of histories, as per usual. What we want to do is to find a generator of this symmetry, a quantity that I will call H delta, such that the Pyrrhus bracket of H delta with an arbitrary field is the change in the field under the symmetry. And thus, as a result, the Pyrrhus bracket of H delta with an arbitrary function on the space of solutions is, in fact, the change in that function under the action of the symmetry. That's what we want, to generate the symmetry. Okay. Nope. That's the great point of this lovely proof. You'll see we need to know nothing about that, because from the Pyrrhus point of view, there's nothing particularly different about canonical momenta than from canonical coordinates. Oh, no, sorry. Let me back up a minute. Phi are the field variables in space-time. So I want H to do this to phi at any time. So it also does it to the time derivatives and everything else. It's all covariant. This is an action on, right. Phi is to be thought of here as a function on the space of solutions, which, if it's phi of x, where x is a point in space-time, looks at that point in space-time on that solution and tells you the value of phi. And it does this for all x. Okay. So the construction is quite straightforward and has many parallels with the usual derivation of Noether's theorem. What we're going to do is distort the symmetry somewhat to make it not a symmetry. No surprise. Okay. I'm going to define a new transformation that I call delta sub f of phi, which is where I have chosen some function f on the space-time, okay, which varies in the space-time, and the new transformation is going to be given by delta sub f of phi is just f times delta phi. Okay, this is a similar thing that you usually do in proving Noether's theorem. Now I want to choose f in a certain form. I'm going to choose two Cauchy surfaces, or more generally, two initial data surfaces in my space-time. I'll call sigma 0 and sigma 1, one to the future of the other. I'm going to choose this function f to vanish in the past, specifically everywhere to the past of this sigma 0, and to be 1 everywhere in the future of sigma 1. And in between, you can smoothly interpolate any way you like. Doesn't matter. So this modified transformation delta f is something that does nothing in the past, is a symmetry in the future, and interpolates between them in some way. Then it turns out, what we can prove very quickly, is that you can find such a generator by simply varying the action under this modified transformation, this non-symmetry. If I varied it under the symmetry, of course, I would get 0. But what I just do is compute the action varied by this delta f, subtract off the action on some original unvaried configuration, and then divide by epsilon and take the limit. Okay. The rest of this page is a proof that this quantity H delta F really does generate this transformation that I'll go through in a moment. But before I get to the proof, it's worth mentioning that we can see immediately that, okay, the action is defined as an integral over the entire space-time, okay, but since we did nothing back before sigma 0, H will contain will not depend on what happens before sigma 0. Also, since we acted by a symmetry after sigma 1, and symmetries don't change the action, H won't care what happens up there either. So H is built from stuff that lives in this sort of compact region of time, sigma 0 to sigma 1. Okay. Yes?
That's
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's the usual story. What's just nice is this proof I'm going to give it here that it generates the symmetry for an arbitrary symmetry without. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good that it is the usual Noether charge. I want to have the usual story. Okay. Great. So let's calculate the Pyrrhus bracket of H with some arbitrary field phi. Okay. Now, what I want to do is use the fact that H has this compact support, so I can using H to modify the action, and then I can impose nice advanced retarded boundary conditions that won't care. Well, anyway, I'll get to that. Okay. Right. What I want to do is compute the Pyrrhus bracket of H delta F with phi, and I guess I didn't write it down explicitly here, but what I want to do is consider the deformation of the action that I get by adding H delta F to the action, and then I'll compute the change in the field phi. Okay. Well, as I just said, H is supported in this region. So if, for example, so I'm going to be effectively adding sources in this region. So if I compute the advanced change in phi, and if for the moment I'm going to make my life easier by choosing a particular field operator which lives to the future of sigma 1. So it lives to the future of the support of H, just to make life easy for the moment. Okay? Since phi lives to the future up here, then it's clear if I impose boundary conditions in the future and evolve down, I don't hit any sources until I hit phi, so the advance change is zero. Okay? That's easy. So now, I need to do the harder thing. I need to compute the retarded change. So now I want to keep phi up here in the future, but impose boundary conditions here in the past, evolve forward through the sources and find out what happens to phi. Well, by construction, if I add my H delta F to the action, by construction, this was just the action evaluated at this transformed set of fields. Right? So it's clear that this operation here, of course, can be thought of as a change of variables on field space. So the modified solutions are just the solutions that are also transformed by that change of variables on field space. So as a result, the modified solution changes just by the change in the solution between the modified and unmodified solutions is just the same change delta F of phi. Okay. And now the point is that if I take the Pyrrhus bracket, which is the advanced change minus the retarded change, and let's not worry about the minus signs because they just confuse me, the advanced change minus the retarded change is 0 minus this thing, which is just delta F of phi. This was for the case where phi was to the future of sigma 1. So in that region, F equals 1. The modified transformation is the same as the symmetry transformation. So for objects to the future of sigma 1, we find that H does indeed generate our symmetry. Okay? All right. Now, it turns out that I'm done. Because this system has a well-defined Cauchy problem. So we know that using the equations of motion, one can express any other quantity localized anywhere else in the space-time, in this region, back here, whatever, as a function of the quantities up here in the future. I've already proven the Pyrrhus bracket respects the equations of motion. Okay. So, if it generates the symmetry acting on these things up here, it must also generate the symmetries on every other function in the space of solutions. Because, if you like, quantities to the future of any Cauchy surface give you a basis in the space of functions in the space of solutions. All right. So, that's the whole story. This is Noether's theorem via the Pyrrhus bracket. And as I say, there's now, of course, the question of how do I go and apply this to the system of interest. It turns out there are some slight subtleties, but they're only somewhat slight. The basic thing to do is to go and use the gravitational action, which is given to us in a nice finite form by Balasubramanian, Krauss, Skinderis, and show that if one simply computes this quantity here, where this is built from something like a time translation or some of your other favorite symmetry, that you do in fact get this quantity over here on the blackboard. Okay? There are some details there, which you're welcome to look up in the paper since I'm essentially out of time. Oh, actually, I'm not out of time. I've got 15 more minutes, don't I? Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right. Well, in that case, you might get a few details. Oops. I'm not sure how many details we really have time for. I haven't actually given the GR course, so I don't know. I think it's done slowly enough, it's quite understandable, but it is somewhat abstract for many beginning graduate students. So I don't know. I'd be happy to have you run an experiment and let me know. All right. What we wish to do is to compute, I guess I think I have time to run through this. All right. Please. Okay. So you can. Well, it's the usual trick that you can usually pick an appropriate region of the spacetime which has a well-defined initial value problem. So for your favorite D-brain spacetimes with null singularities, there's really no problem. The spacetime is globally hyperbolic, it's just not geodesically complete. Okay, there's a singularity, but you there's no way to go around it. There's no other place to ask for evolution, you don't need any new. That is, everywhere that the spacetime makes sense, the evolution is well-defined. Okay, Schwarzschild black holes are also fine, because everywhere the solution makes sense, they're well-defined. Reiser-Nernstrom black holes are a little more problematic because they have, what's that? So the exact Kerr solution, Reiser-Nernstrom black holes, are slightly more problematic because they have time-like singularities. Okay, there are two ways to deal with this. One is to argue that, well, the space-time you're probably really interested in is some small perturbation of that, and we know that the Cauchy horizon is unstable, and therefore this is a fake problem and we can ignore it. You can also just decide that you're going to sort of slice out the bad region of the space-time and look at the rest of it, which is globally hyperbolic. So, yeah. So there's no real problem, I think, for using this kind of story. Let's put it this way. The question that you might have asked, the question that you might have been trying to ask to make it very concrete is, if I have a space-time that looks like this, it's got a singularity in it, all right, and I have some field quantity that, which is localized here, okay, like phi of x at this point, okay, you might have asked me, well, if I compute Q holographic charge, and I take its Pyrrhus bracket with this quantity here, you might have said, well, what is that? Because after all, the equations of motion don't really tell me how this thing evolves. There's no well-defined initial value problem. And you're right. In that case, if there's an operator you're concerned about which lives in the sort of region of influence of some singularity, I have nothing to say. But my guess is you don't know what to do with this creature either. So that's just the usual story. If you do know how to make sense of this, say by imposing boundary conditions at the singularity, then this story goes through. This story doesn't mind if the theory is geodesically incomplete, as long as you have enough boundary conditions to make the evolution well-defined. Okay. So if you can talk about a meaningful classical space-time with meaningful physics, I think we can use this story. Okay. Let's see. Gosh. I'm tempted to just call it quits here and say you'll believe the rest of my story. Would you like to see some details? All right. Well, Okay. I tell you what, maybe I'll summarize this quickly, leaving out the things that would explain various details, and then we can officially call it done, and you can, those who are interested can ask questions, and I'll fill in the gaps. All right. So here's the one-page calculation for the case of interest. We want to consider gravity in ADS, and the story is that we want to do this calculation carefully, keeping track of all boundary terms that would ever arise. So you don't do any of this, do it, integrate by parts and throw away the boundary term. You keep everything. And the story is that people like Skinderis and Beltzmann and Krauss and so forth have cleverly found boundary terms we can add to the gravitational action that make everything nice and finite. So what we want to do is consider something that should be a symmetry. Well, what should be a symmetry of a gravitational theory? What kind of symmetry are we going to have that's associated with energy? Well, we don't have a fixed space-time. So we don't have a time translation killing vector field. What we have is a whole class of killing vector fields that are what are called asymptotic symmetries. They're things which in the middle they can do whatever they want because you have a kind of diffeomorphism symmetry. But what should happen is that on the boundary of the space-time, they become a symmetry. Okay? So we want to consider what I call it, what we call an asymptotic isometry. What is that? It's a diffeomorphism generated by some vector field in the space-time, which has a few properties. First of all, to make sense in terms of this whole program, since we had to pick a conformal factor omega in order to define things in the first place, thank you very much, this diffeomorphism should preserve the function omega, at least asymptotically, at least to leading order around infinity. It should also preserve the boundary metric. It should be an isometry of the boundary theory. Okay? Good. In that case, it should generate a symmetry of the action. One can check that it does. The transformation on the space of fields, well, the case of interest is going to be where the field of most interest is the bulk gravitational field. So if I act with diffeomorphism, what transformation does that generate? How does the diffeo act on the metric? Well, it adds the metric 2 times the symmetrized covariant derivative along the vector field. Okay. Again, since chi is in general not an isometry, this doesn't vanish, but this is the transformation. What we were told to do in the general construction of Noether's theorem is to modify this a little bit by putting in some space-time-dependent function f here. So the transformation is now not given explicitly by the asymptotic symmetry, but it's the asymptotic symmetry times some function f. And we're supposed to compute what is the variation of the action. F again will vanish in the past, be one in the future, and something different in between. Okay. In general, the variation of the action gives you something which involves the equations of motion integrated over the bulk. We're going to be interested in this on shell when the equation of motion vanishes, so we don't care about that term. Then in general, you can get terms that are boundary terms. Okay? Well, one of the boundary terms you get comes from how things change at the boundary out here, the boundary at the edge of space, so to speak. That is actually, by definition, this holographic stress energy tensor times the variation of the metric, because if I pull back down this blackboard, it will remind you that that's how this object was defined. It's the variation of the action spectrometric on the boundary. And there are, in general, other terms that come from past and future boundaries, which I'll just call plus and minus infinity. There are also, in general, I will point out, there are in general other terms. If the metric is not the only field of interest, but if you have dynamical scalar fields, and if, for example, you wish to prescribe some non-trivial boundary values for those scalar fields, then there are in general other terms, but let me ignore those for now. That's just a thing to mention. Okay. So there are these. So if we ignore the other fields, there's the bulk term, there is the term from varying the boundary metric, and there is the terms at past and future. Now, it turns out that this guy is also zero. Why is this zero? It's because we started out with a diffeomorphism which gives us an isometry of the boundary metric. So if I looked at the change in h when I act with this diffeo, that would have been the change in h would have been 2 times the covariant derivative on the boundary of the vector field, and that would have vanished. Okay? Now, but I've now modified the transformation, but all that I've done is said, think about how things would have changed in the original symmetry, and multiply that answer by f. So if the original change would have been 0, multiplied by f, I still get 0. Okay? So this is also 0. So in fact, as is always the case for such things, the symmetry generator on shell can be expressed purely in terms of boundary terms of the past and future. Okay. Now, we want to use that observation to write this in a form useful for our purposes, namely to write it in a form that involves, in a non-trivial way, the boundary stress energy tensor, since here it dropped out. Okay. So what we note is that in the far past and far future, our function f is constant. As a result, let's look at the transformation we tried to use here, this delta f. We modified the metric by adding to it 2 times f times the symmetrized covariant derivative of the vector field chi, generating the symmetry. Well, at either far past or far future, where f is constant in an open region, I can take this f and push it inside the derivative. I mean constant. I mean f is constant everywhere to the future of sigma 1 and constant everywhere to the future of sigma 0. So if I'm in the far future up here, f is constant. In the far past down here, f is constant. So in those regions, and in those regions alone, I can push it inside the derivative for free. So what that means, though, is that in the interesting region, which is giving us all of the actual activity here, this is equivalent to acting with a diffeomorphism generated by f times chi. Okay? So let's think about the change in the action under the actual diffeomorphism generated by f times chi. That is, not under f times the action given with the diffeomorphism by chi, but under the diffeomorphism f chi. Okay? That has to vanish by diffeo invariance. But it vanishes in an interesting way, as often happens. It has a bulk part, which is 0 because we're on shell. It has a non-trivial part on the boundary at spatial infinity because f times chi is not a killing vector field of the boundary metric. Okay? And it has some boundary terms at past and future. And the point is that because this transformation here is the same as this transformation at past and future, it's the same boundary terms. So, turning this all around, what we see is that what we wanted to compute was this creature here. It's given by these boundary terms, which I didn't want to write down because I didn't have a lot of explicit notation for it, but which are the same as these boundary terms, and therefore equal to, since this and this sum to 0, it's equal to basically this guy with the right sign. And so, in the end, we conclude that as one would like, that indeed, on shell, the Noether conserved quantity, which we've shown generates our symmetry, is nothing other than the integral over the entire boundary at spatial infinity of the boundary stress energy tensor times the symmetrized covariant derivative of this funny vector field, f times chi, which is not a symmetry. However, what we notice is that by the usual kind of argument, T is conserved. Its covariant divergence is 0. And of course, H is covariantly constant. So I can pull this derivative out front. This is indeed, therefore, a total divergence. I can write it as a difference of two boundary terms at the intersection of past and future infinity with the boundary. Okay. But since there's an f in here, and f is 0 in the far past, one of those boundary terms doesn't contribute. F is 1 in the far future, and we have just the usual expression that it's the integral over the surface in the far future of the term of the metric times an appropriate normal, the killing field, the asymptotic killing field, and the stress energy tensor. And you can use the usual conservation argument to then move this back to any finite slice you like. I think the answer to that question depends on what exactly you're doing. I mean, you should ask me more of that later. I mean, one can apply this argument to black hole space times without any problem by simply using the equations of motion in the interior. Let us discuss the boundary of the horizon of black hole a bit more later, but it has nothing to do with this. Okay, so in fact, I am done. This now gives a general argument that as long as one may use these Pyrrhus techniques, which basically means as long as one has some useful notion of past and future events retarded boundary conditions associated with the boundary space-time, so for anything vaguely ADS CFT-like, indeed, these counterterm charges, these holographic charges, will generate the right symmetries of the system, and therefore they will differ from any other symmetry generators by things which are entirely a C number. And we've seen that in the case where we focus only on the gravitational field, they're given by the usual expression of the stress energy tensor. If you keep track of the details, if there are other interesting boundary fields, it turns out there are in general other terms. This perhaps is no surprise. This is just to say that if your quantum field theory happened to live in an external electric field, there would be some contribution to the energy from sort of the potential energy due to the electric field or whatever other potentials are in the problem. They come out by the same argument, and you can write down all the terms in some reasonably closed form expression that you can look up in our paper if you're interested. Okay, so I think I'm done. Thank you very much.